Welcome back to Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. Everything right now is COVID-19, and so is Question Medicine. Luckily for me, the literature coming out on coronavirus or COVID-19 has been absolutely borderline horrendous, and there is no shortage of things to question. So with that, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, coronavirus. It's on everyone's mind. It's all everyone talks about. And the reason we're talking about it so much is because we have nothing to do for it. We can do absolutely nothing. Yes, we can do some airway management. Yes, we can watch them. Yes, we can put a mask on them. But once they get going bad, once they are down the road of badness, it seems to just continue until it ultimately ends. And there are very few individuals that somehow recover from the badness to see discharge. The data coming out of China and New York shows somewhere around 90-ish to 100-ish percent of individuals who are intubated eventually die. The sicker you become of this, and then ultimately it becomes the event that will be the event that causes your mortality. Now, there was a publication that just came out in JAMA titled Pharmacological Treatments for Coronavirus Disease 2019, COVID-19, a Review. This is April 13th, 2020. And for those of you that are listening and wondering, it is April 14th right now, 2020. So this is only one day old. In this review, I will just read you the conclusion because I think it summarizes what I want to get out of the paper. And it was pretty good. The conclusion says, and I quote, "The COVID-19 pandemic represents the greatest global public health crisis of this generation." They're not lying. "And potentially since the pandemic influenza outbreak of 1918. Also, probably not lying. The speed and volume of clinical trials launched to investigate potential therapies for COVID-19 highlight both the need and capability to produce high-quality evidence in the middle of a pandemic. No therapies have been shown effective to date." It's that final line right there. No therapies have been shown effective to date, and they are totally spot on. No therapies have been shown effective to date because the literature that we have, as I've discussed on Question Medicine, has been absolutely 100% horrendous. But I was intrigued. I was intrigued to see what they would say about remdesivir. See, remdesivir could potentially work. It has a mechanism that we think that maybe possibly it could work. And when you go to their little summary, because this is just a review, they're just reviewing every single article that's come out on therapies for this. And when you go to their little review, it says, "Clinical trials are ongoing to evaluate the safety and antiviral activity of remdesivir in patients with mild to moderate or severe COVID-19. But that is because this article came out on Monday. Yes, Monday of this week. And there was just an article published on Friday of last week, which is part of the problem right now, is that there's so much information coming out that anytime that you read something, if you're reading it just even one day, 24, 48 hours after it was published, then you're already behind the times because it's coming out so quickly. The article that was published on Friday in the New England Journal of Medicine titled "Compassionate Use of Remdesivir for Patients with Severe COVID-19. This was in the glorious, wonderful New England Journal of Medicine on April 10th. And this article sparked some hype, not to mention a tweet from the New England Journal of Medicine, which says, and I quote from their tweet, "A cohort of patients with severe COVID-19 received treatment with remdesivir under a compassionate use protocol. improvement in oxygen support status was observed in 68% of the patients, and overall mortality was 13% over a median follow-up of 26 days. Hashtag COVID-19. Now, if you just read that tweet, you would say, ooh, look at this. We now have a study. We have something that shows that remdesivir, this antiviral, may be beneficial. It's improving oxygen support. It's lowering, we think, maybe, hopefully, the mortality. And then I went and read the study, and that's not at all what the study says. So let's break down this study as we have broken down hydroxychloroquine and try to figure out what went right and what went wrong. So let's start with the basics. First, the results. It was a manufacturer-funded case series of 53 patients with COVID-19 who received remdesivir through a compassionate use program. Now, before receiving the remdesivir, patients' median symptom duration was 12 days. 57% of the patients were on mechanical ventilation or intubated, and 8% of the patients were on ECMO. And when you looked at the outcomes 18 days after receiving remdesivir, it was impressive. I will not deny that. You see, the need for oxygen support improved in 68% of the patients. Of those receiving mechanical ventilation, 57% were extubated. 3 of 4 people on ECMO stopped getting ECMO, and 47% of the patients had been discharged from the hospital. Those are really good numbers until you look at this data with a critical eye. Because if you just read what I just said, well, then you would say, wait a second, 57% of the patients were extubated? I mean, come on. When we're looking at data out of China that says 90%+ of those individuals who are intubated never get extubated except for when they are being buried in their casket, when you're looking at this kind of data and now you're saying almost 60% of the individuals are extubated, this must be amazing? Well, you would think until you look at it closely. So let's look at where this study went wrong, and I will number them off for you. Here we go. Number one. First of all, there was no placebo. This was an IV therapy. It would have been super easy if you actually believe that this drug worked, and since it was a drug manufactured funded study, I'm sure that the manufacturer does actually believe in their drug, because that's why they're running the trial. It would have been super easy to run a placebo of 500 mLs or 250 mLs of normal saline. That would have been a simple thing to do. They didn't do it. I wish that they would have. I'm sure we all know why they didn't do it, because then you wouldn't guarantee a positive study in the New England Journal of Medicine. Number two, there was no control group. Similar to no placebo, but not quite. You see, we had nothing to compare these patients with. We don't know how these exact patients maybe randomized the same exact chocolate pudding or yogurt or vitamin D or what other placebo in this world you want to say. We don't know what those individuals would have had as their outcome, and maybe they all would have gotten better with no matter what we did. So just no control group. Blah. What do you do with that? Frustrating. And I think I know why they did it, because you don't get your paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine when you have a negative trial. Number three. And I quote, Gilead Sciences, which Gilead is the company that makes remdesivir, Gilead Sciences began accepting requests from clinicians for compassionate use of remdesivir on January 25th, 2020. They then go on to say, follow-up was to continue through at least 28 days after the beginning of treatment with remdesivir. Data that were collected through March 30th, 2020 are reported here. Hold on, wait one second. So you started enrollment January 25th. You watched for 28 days to see what would happen, and then you reported your data through March 30th and published it in the New England Journal of Medicine on April 10th. The good news is, with that long of a turnaround, there probably was peer publication or peer reviewed for this study. But being that you wanted to watch these individuals for 28 days, you basically ran a trial for a little over 60 days, but you wanted to watch him for 28, so you needed to enroll all your patients in the first 35 days, but you only enrolled 60 patients. That means that in the height of a pandemic, in countries such as Germany, France, Austria, Italy, Japan, United States, Spain, and Canada, in the height of a pandemic, over the course of 65 days, of which only the first 30 you could actually enroll patients because you want to have them follow up for 28 days, you enrolled 60 patients. That's less than 2 patients a day, which means that you were either really strict about your inclusion criteria or there wasn't very many people with the coronavirus because you couldn't actually enroll very many people. And since we know that there are quite a few people with the coronavirus, you can just go to any city and you're going to find them. It must be that they were really strict about the inclusion criteria, right? Well, you would think, except there is no good description of the individuals that are enrolled in this study. They say, and I quote, "Clinicians completed an assessment form with demographic and disease status information about their patient. Approval was reserved for hospital patients who had COVID-19 infection and either an oxygen saturation of 94% or less, a creatinine clearance above 30 mL per minute, and serum levels of ALT and AST less than 5 times the upper limit of normal." So basically, their inclusion criteria was you had to have the coronavirus, you had to have an oxygen saturation that was less than 94% on room air, and then your kidney function and liver function had to be, if not normal, at least not significantly abnormal. What they were looking for here was individuals that are really sick with this disease, but we don't want them too sick because we actually want to show some benefit here. So if you could just give us people that are pretty healthy, but we don't want them too healthy. We actually want them to have the disease because then our study will be beneficial, but we do want them to be just sick enough that we can enroll them and say, oh, look how sick the patients were. Look how much they benefited from remdesivir. Oh, the Herculean drug that is remdesivir. Oh, it just rolls off your tongue, doesn't it? It just rolls off your tongue like a rom-com that your wife makes you watch during a pandemic. But I digress. On to number 4. You might have noticed that I said 53 patients, but you see, initially, there were 61 patients that were randomized, and 8 patients were thrown out of the evaluation or analysis because of those 8, 7 of those patients had, and I quote, "no post-day 1 clinical data." The question is, what does that even mean? No day 1 data? You enroll these patients into your study and then you don't have data from day 1? What happened to them? Where did they go? You knew that they were in the hospital. You just enrolled them in your study and then you dropped them out of your study. Did they die? Did they get transferred to the ICU? Did they get intubated when previously they weren't intubated? What happened to these patients that you just magically kicked out of your final analysis? Number 5, and I quote, "no sample size calculations were performed." I read that and I also thought to myself, what does that even mean? How can you have no sample size calculations? I mean, if you don't have a sample size calculation, then how will you know when to stop the study? How will you know when you have reached enough of the primary endpoints that you know what you're looking for? How will you know if the drug is causing harm and killing people really fast if you don't have endpoints that are looking for harm? How do you know if you don't do a sample size to know how many people you need to enroll in your study? And then number 6, and I quote again, "although there were no pre-specified endpoints for this program, we quantified the incidence of key clinical events, including changes in oxygen requirements, hospital discharge, and reported adverse events, including those leading to discontinuation of treatment, serious adverse events, and death." So, what they're saying is, this makes total sense. If you have no pre-specified endpoints, then you actually don't know what you're looking for at all. And basically everything is an endpoint. And you only need to report the positive findings or whatever you paid the people writing the study or the paper to find, because you only need the positive results so you can get your paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine. If you have no endpoint in mind, any road will get you there. I think that's the saying. I think that's how it goes. Number seven, as I said previously in number six, it doesn't matter then what the endpoint was or what the outcomes were, because you had all the data in front of you and you could just dig to figure out what you were looking for and then tell the person that you paid to write the manuscript what to write. And that is because number seven is the initial draft of the manuscript was prepared by a writer employed by Gilead Sciences along with one of the authors, with input from all of the authors. End quote. This isn't as bad as it typically is, where it just says, we had a ghostwriter write this whole dang thing, and then we put a bunch of authors on there. But this is still really bad. If you look at this, there are 20 or 30 authors on this paper. The author list alone probably takes up the entire first page of the PDF, and I'm almost not exaggerating at all. But they paid someone to write the manuscript of the data that they had to say what they wanted it to say, and then the rest of the authors just slap their name on it. Only in academic medicine that is so prestigious for the New England Journal of Medicine would we allow individuals to just throw their name on something that they didn't write. I know college is not in session right now, but if you're a college student listening, if you're a medical student listening, I dare you to turn in a paper next time you have one due and say, this paper was written by my roommate who I paid to write this piece, but I have put my name on it because that is what seems to be deemed acceptable by the New England Journal of Medicine, so thus I am using it as acceptable use of resources for this paper, end quote. And just go ahead and message me, Andrew Belt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com, and let me know what the grade was, what the response was, because I'm sure, based on the standards that we're currently looking at, you're going to get an A. Number eight, and I quote, the median duration of symptoms before the initiation of remdesivir treatment was 12 days, end quote. If you make it to day 12 with the coronavirus, a positive diagnosis of the coronavirus, you're probably going to be okay. Not always, but probably. And of the people in this study, remember, you had to be 94% or less on room air just to be enrolled in the study. But of the individuals in the study, 12 people, or almost 20 to 25% of the people, were on room air or low flow nasal cannula when they were enrolled in the study. These individuals who have had the disease for 12 days and 12 out of your 50 patients are on room air or on low flow nasal cannula, those individuals were gonna be fine. It didn't matter what medication you gave them. It's easy to show a 50% discharge from the hospital when 20 to 25% of your population at baseline probably could have been discharged from the hospital day one. If they're on room air, why are they even in the hospital? If they're on low dose nasal cannula, you can send them home. And people are sending them home with home oxygen canisters. Those people didn't need to be admitted to begin with, but you included them in your study. Why? Because you can't get it published in the New England Journal of Medicine if it's a negative study, but you sure can if it's a positive study. Number nine, and this is just for those individuals out there that think, Andrew, you're way too strict. You're way too stringent on the drug company. You are just out there thinking that everyone is evil and bad and that every drug company during this pandemic is trying to make a quick buck, a quick dollar. And I will say you are probably right. I do think that a lot of them are trying to make a quick buck around our fear that maybe if we can post some really cruddy study out there that excluded six people that on hydroxychloroquine and we can get the president to say our drug one time on the air, all of a sudden there will be a spike of hydroxychloroquine that is so ridiculously high that those individuals that actually need it can't get it. Well, then you're right. That is what I think. But this line in the paper, to me, summarizes the entire paper. The program, meaning the study, was designed and conducted by the sponsor, Gilead Sciences. In accordance with the protocol, the sponsor collected the data, monitored conduct of the program, and performed the statistical analysis, end quote. What they're saying here is that this drug company that obviously has a very vested interest in making a buck here, or a dollar, or a penny, or anything, 50 cent if they have to, two quarters, I don't care what you want to call it, they have a vested interest in seeing a positive outcome here, paid for the trial, conducted the trial, they monitored it to get the results that they looked for, collected the data, performed the statistical analysis on the data, and then hired someone to write the paper for them, and then threw some authors onto the backside. This paper has done nothing. If I thought that this drug, remdesivir, would actually work for COVID-19 prior to this paper, well, then I could still think that maybe it will work. If I didn't think that it worked at all reading this paper, I still don't think that it works at all. It's wherever you think it is, that's what it is. If anything, it leans me towards this doesn't probably work, but I have no idea because there's so many flaws in it that it is just an awful paper. We need good studies. And each week, I am hopeful that we're going to have these good studies. And each week, I am disappointed. It's probably with good reason. Good science takes a while. However, our fear and anxiety makes us all believe that we don't have a while. We don't have any time. But it's better to do it right once the first time than it is to do it 600 times over of small, terribly done, non-blinded, no control, drug-sponsored trial, drug-written trial, where you throw out 6 patients because you don't have the data for them, and you don't pre-specify your endpoints, and you don't do a sample calculation. It's just better to do it once than to try to throw this poor excuse of a paper up for the world as reasonable and viable and usable science. And with that, and as I've said during all of these for the coronavirus, if you've learned one thing from this podcast, if you took anything away from this at all, I encourage you, please send it to one friend on the front lines, whether it be a nurse, a tech, a physical therapist, occupational therapist, respiratory therapist, a physician, a PA, a nurse practitioner, send it to one friend. And together we can spread the knowledge, not the bad knowledge, but the good knowledge, because we all want the same thing. We're all scared. We all want to do what's best for the patient. So until next time, I will end this podcast as I've ended every one before it. Keep the quest and questioning.